I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, Senator Ben Cardin joins me. President Trump says North Korea's recent test of short-range missiles don't bother him. Today in Tokyo, Trump called North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un a, quote, very smart man. German Chancellor Angela Merkel warns that dark forces are on the rise in Europe as populist parties gain traction in the European Parliament. Here at home, abortion rights are eroded in states across the South and Midwest. Democrats on Capitol Hill and on the campaign trail talk about fixing infrastructure and health care and whether congressional investigations into the Trump administration should lead to impeachment. We'll talk to Senator Ben Cardin about these issues and more when Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I hope you had a nice Memorial Day holiday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. My guest today is Senator Ben Cardin. He's represented Maryland on Capitol Hill since 1987, first in the House, where he represented Maryland's 3rd congressional district. He was elected to the Senate in 2007, and before that, he was a member of the Maryland House of Delegates for 2 decades. Senator Cardin is the ranking member of the Senate Small Business and Entrepreneurship Committee. He is a senior member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's also a member of the Environment and Public Works and Finance Committees. We will take your calls and comments a little bit later in the program. For now, you can check us out on the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. Senator, welcome back. Good to see you.
Tom, it's always good to be with you, particularly in studio. It's great to be here.
Yeah, glad you could make it. So let's talk first about the trip that President Trump has just finished up in Japan with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. North Korea found itself on the agenda in a press conference that he gave early today. He said he wasn't bothered by the short-range missile tests that North Korea conducted last week. Prime Minister Abe, in contrast, of course, characterized those tests as of great regret. What do you make of that?
Well, Tom, I don't think we should ever get just immune to the president's comments that we let it go without commenting about it. What the president said is outrageous. It conflicts with his own national security team. It conflicts with the facts on the ground. It was said with a close ally in total disagreement. To embrace Kim Jong-un, who is now again testing, who has a nuclear weapon, who has made no concessions whatsoever to the president of the United States, it demeans the thousands of U.S. soldiers who lost their life. This is Memorial Day. We honored them in the Korean War for the stability in that part of the world. I say that recognizing that we want to have dialogue. We want to have diplomacy. We want to have conversations, including with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. But to misstate the facts and to give Kim Jong-un credibility for what he's done is just absolutely outrageous.
Is it, in your opinion, a violation of UN Security Council resolutions regarding missile testing? Because the president seems to think that it's not. He said that his team, meaning his national security advisor, Mr. Bolton, and others, did think it was a violation of UN Security Council resolutions. Where do you stand on that?
I think the North Korean regime under Kim Jong-un is violating the UN Security Council resolutions. They are violating the nonproliferation commitments. They are violating international norms, and they're putting the region at great risk.
We have the specter of Mr. Trump in Helsinki with Vladimir Putin, in which he seemed to side with Mr. Putin over the opinion of U.S. intelligence agencies. We have his very milquetoast reaction to the Saudi Arabian crown prince, known as MBS, regarding the killing of the journalist for the Washington Post, Jamal Khashoggi. And now we have him seeming to prop up Kim Jong-un as he stands 10 feet away from Shinzo Abe in Japan. What does this do to American standing abroad? What does this do to the prospects for formulating a coherent and effective foreign policy in around the world?
The U.S. is looked upon as the leader of the free world. We are the defender of democracy. We have established the norm for what can be tolerated. And now that is being questioned. Our credibility is very much on the line with the president embracing despots, embracing dictators, Kim Jong-un or Vladimir Putin, or what's happened in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. All that weakens the U.S. position globally and puts us at risk on protecting the values of democratic states.
You've been critical of the president for his refusal to mention human rights when it comes to Russia, when it comes to all of these examples we've just mentioned. How is it that we can incorporate a concern about human rights into a conversation with someone like, for example, Kim Jong-un, when the end game is, you know, putatively to have North Korea denuclearized?
Tom, it's a great question. America's strength is the values that we stand for. It's who we are as a nation, our respect for everyone's human rights, for the gender issues, for dealing with against human trafficking, for standing up against corruption. That's what America stands for: democratic institutions, free and fair elections. Our relationships with other countries must be embraced upon what we stand for as a nation. It doesn't mean we will not engage other countries who don't share our values. We do engage other countries, whether it's Russia or whether it's North Korea or whether it's the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. But it must be based upon our principles. And when the president meets with Vladimir Putin and doesn't bring up human rights, he weakens America and America's influence. What the president did in not holding accountable the Crown Prince in regards to the Khashoggi tragedy is just weakens America's strength. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia needs the United States, and when we don't embrace the values that we stand for, we make it easy for another country to do what they're doing against our national security interests. So, yes, we must engage Russia on what it's doing. We must engage North Korea on its nuclear programs. We must engage Iran on its issues, but we must do it within the framework of America's values, and that's our strength.
My guest is Senator Ben Cardin. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. A little bit later, we'll take your calls and comments. You can catch us now on the WYPR Facebook page, where for the hour we will be streaming our conversation. Speaking of Saudi Arabia, it appears that the president has done a kind of end run around Congress affected an arms sale to Saudi Arabia. Is there a legislative remedy for this?
I hope that the courts will intervene and just state the obvious that the president is trying to take away the power of the Congress. He did that with the emergency spending on the wall that Congress specifically rejected. There is no emergency. He's using an emergency declaration to provide weapons to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, even though this circumstance has been deteriorating for a long time and there's no new emergency why they would need weapons from the United States. It's just the reverse. We should not be giving them weapons to continue the atrocities that are occurring in Yemen. The sole fault of the kingdom, the Houthi rebels are very much responsible for a lot of the tragedies in that part of the world. But there's certainly no new emergency that would circumvent the congressional notification and approval process. So clearly the president is taking away the power of the Congress. I hope we do act. I hope that we find a way. But to date, we have not been able to get enough Republicans to join us in Congress to override presidential vetoes. So I don't know whether we effectively can act as a Congress, but clearly the president is doing things that are within the purview of the Congress.
When it comes to the Republicans' response to some of the things that we're talking about here, behavior of the president, a soon-to-be former colleague of yours, Senator Tom Udall from New Mexico, who's announced that he's not seeking reelection because he says that the Senate is broken. Over the weekend, to my knowledge, Senator Joni Ernst from Iowa is the only Republican senator to stand up and say Mr. Trump's comments about North Korea at his press conference with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe were inappropriate and wrong, unless there's newer information that you know that I may not know. But what do you make of Republicans' reluctance to be critical of the president in these really basic issues? I mean, when we talk about the attenuation of the democratic separation of powers and when we talk about embracing dictators, it seems quite quite unbelievable that they wouldn't stand up.
I'm certainly disappointed that our Republican colleagues are not standing up when there's a fundamental issue involved here, the power of the Congress, our responsibilities for oversight. The Mueller report clearly puts the responsibility on Congress to follow up on his findings in regards to what Russia did in the United States, but as well as what the president did to try to change the investigation, to influence the investigation. So I'm clearly disappointed. I must tell you, though, that I have a great love for our institution, for the Constitution, for what our framers were able to develop, and believe that our Constitution and our system will survive. We miss John McCain. Believe me, we miss him. We miss two of our colleagues who are no longer with us who chose not to run for re-election, Bob Corker and Jeff Flake, who stood up to the president. These are all Republicans who stood up to President Trump when he crossed the line. He has crossed the line many times, and very few of my Republican colleagues will join us in a way that respects the checks and balances of our system. It's not a partisan issue. It's a congressional responsibility to be a check on the president. We did that as Democrats against Democratic administrations. We need the Republicans to join us to hold this president in line, because he's crossed the line so many times. And what is the power of the Congress, our oversight function, our appropriation function, that's our responsibility, and this president's crossed the line. We also have to rein him in when he's wrong on foreign policy. That's our responsibility. We did that at the beginning of this term when we had a strong bipartisan vote in regards to Russia. We need to do this again.
Then what is it going to take to add to that argument to be convincing and persuasive to your colleagues on the other side of the aisle? Because it seems like there's a certain level of almost fecklessness in Congress when it comes to the behavior of this president. People have been talking now for 2 years about how he crosses the line. He's done these terrible things, everything from the emoluments clause in his personal business to outrageous behavior and possible obstruction of justice to these important investigations. But he keeps on doing it. And there's a new, mini scandal du jour every day. I mean, what's it going to take for the hump to get gotten over to really, in fact, rein in a president who so many people seem to think is out of control?
Well, I think we're going to have to work on specific issues. I do think we have a significant number of members of Republican members of the Senate who agree that the president is wrong in regards to the way he's handled the Khashoggi tragedy in Saudi Arabia, that he's wrong in the way that he's dealing with Kim Jong-un in North Korea, that he's wrong in the way that he's dealing with Vladimir Putin and Russia. I think there's a working majority in the Senate.
But you know that because of private conversations with them. I mean, is there anybody saying this on the record? Not to my knowledge.
There are some, but there are few. There should be more. There's no question that it is frustrating. We have to recognize the reality of politics, that the Republicans have seen what President Trump has done to Republicans who disagree with the president. So there is a fear factor, a political fear factor. That's no excuse. I think on fundamental issues, you've got to stand up for what's right for our country. And we hope that will happen.
When you have conversations with a Lindsey Graham from South Carolina or any of the other leaders in the Republican side, and you say the argument that a million people have adduced, for example, if Barack Obama as a Democrat had said the things that Donald Trump has said as a Republican, Republicans would be jumping up and down and going crazy. When you say that, make that argument, what's their response?
If the cameras aren't rolling, they agree. They said, we have a problem in the White House. And that we have a problem in that the American people are supporting the president. Now, that's in their constituency, and the president does have substantial support among the American people. So they may agree with us in private, but they say the political realities is it's not just the president. It's his support base that he has.
We'll have more with Democratic Senator Ben Cardin, and we'll take your calls and comments when we come back to Midday after a quick break. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To drop us a tweet, it's @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Stick around. welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, an update on the ransomware attack on the Baltimore City government. Scott Shane of the New York Times and Avi Rubin of Johns Hopkins University join me to talk about the origins of the malware that has crippled the city for nearly a month. Turns out it was stolen from U.S. intelligence agencies. Baltimore isn't the only city that had to wrestle with this problem, which affects many individuals as well, and we'll talk about it tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, Senator Ben Cardin is my guest. You are welcome to be part of our conversation with the senator at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. To drop us a tweet, it's @MiddayWIPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWIPR. And you can always catch us on the WIPR Facebook page as well. We are streaming our conversation. Senator, let me ask you about Iran. The administration, there was a story a couple of weeks ago about a consideration of maybe as many as 120,000 troops sent to the Mideast. Now we're told it's 1,500 troops. State Department has asked non-emergency personnel to leave Iraq. There are bombers and large ships that are being deployed to that area. What do you make of the current tensions with Iran?
Well, I'm extremely concerned that there could be a miscalculation that could lead to military conflict. And if that starts, it's going to be very difficult to see an end in sight. There really is not a military solution here. And the miscalculation could be on the Iranian part. They are concerned as to what America's intentions are all about. They see our military movement. They know that we pulled out of an agreement, even though they were in compliance on the nuclear side of the agreement that was entered into under the Obama administration. They also see us declaring their military to be a terrorist group, and they are concerned about that as well. So there could be a miscalculation by Iran that could lead us into an armed conflict, and then America is isolated. We don't have our traditional allies. Our traditional allies are still surprised that we pulled out of the Iran nuclear agreement. So we really are not in a strong position at this particular moment as it relates to what could happen with Iran. I do think this administration recognizes there's no military solution. I don't think they want to go to war. But at times, you have to protect your interests, and if someone feels threatened and strikes, you got to do what you got to do. So I think this is an extremely dangerous situation. I think the administration's policies towards Iran were wrong. I was not a supporter of the Iran nuclear agreement, but very much opposed the administration unilaterally pulling out of the agreement while Iran was in compliance and isolating America rather than isolating Iran. I was very strongly in support of working with our European allies to isolate Iran on their non-nuclear issues. And we had their support to do that prior to the president pulling out of the Iran agreement. So I think the situation is in very, very dangerous.
When we pulled out of the Iran nuclear agreement, sanctions were reimposed on Tehran, and they announced earlier this month that it will withdraw from part of the deal in July unless some of those sanctions are gotten rid of. What should our response be at that juncture? That's coming right around the corner.
I think it's a little bit different than that. I think they said they want the Europeans to compensate for what the Americans have done in reimposing sanctions. There's no question that we have hurt Iran economically by reimposing sanctions. There's no question about that. The challenge is, for what reason? Where are we heading on this? And if the president wants to use diplomacy, he's done it in a very awkward way. So what we hope is that we can find a path forward on diplomacy.
I have a couple of questions from listeners concerning environmental policy. Sonia writes on Facebook, I'm wondering whether the senator plans to sign on to the resolution of the Green New Deal. If he doesn't support the Green New Deal, what is his plan for addressing the climate crisis at the scale at which it confronts us? And Catherine sends an email as well, says, I believe that climate change is the number one issue that we should be addressing. Time is running out. What can we do about it now?
Well, I agree with both of the individuals. The climate issues is one of the highest priority, has to be one of our highest international priorities. It is going to have extreme, already has extreme impact on our global community. It's a situation where time is running out. We have to do things with the international community. Every country in the world signed on to the Paris Climate Agreements. Now one country has withdrawn, the United States. It's embarrassing and it's dangerous. So I very strongly support an aggressive policy for the United States leadership on climate issues. And by the way, it will also help our economy, in addition to our environment and our national security. So for all those reasons, we should be the leader on the climate agenda. The Green New Deal, the resolution, it's a resolution. It's not an action item. It's more of a manifesto.
It's not a bill.
It's not a bill. If you read it,
yeah.
I don't think there's much in there people would disagree with if you read it. Now, it can be interpreted a lot of different ways, as we've seen from Republicans trying to put a partisan spin on this issue, saying it would bankrupt America and et cetera. It's not at all what it says. So I would urge people to please read it. But we also recognize that the Republicans are using it politically. So working with the proponents of the Green New Deal, we're not going to let the Republicans divide us. Democrats are united in dealing with climate issues and will continue to be. We believe that we can be much more aggressive on the use of renewable energy sources, green energy. This week, I'll be out at one of our waste treatment facility plants talking about how we're going to get to a very positive position on using green technology. So we're going to continue to take the high ground on America's leadership on climate and on green energy.
Do you agree with the premise of the Green New Deal, which is that in addition to, you know, getting rid of fossil fuels and addressing the environmental concerns, it has to do with employment, it has to do with, you know, the changing nature of work in the United States, and that because climate change is such a big problem, even though our current president doesn't recognize it as such, it requires a sweeping, gigantic approach, the way that Franklin Roosevelt approached the stock market crash with the New Deal that was meant to get the economy back on its feet.
Yes, I agree with the premise. I believe it does require a major refocus of our commitment on energy policy, but I think we can do it in a way that's not disruptive at all to our economy. It can be very positive to help our economy. So I think we could do it in a way that is much more understanding of a transition to where we need to be rather than an abrupt change.
So you, in that regard, are you in concert with the Republicans who say this would be hugely disruptive to the economy? I mean, if it's a sweeping program, how does that in and of itself disrupt the economy?
Well, the Republicans will say it's going to cost X dollars, and they're wrong about that. So we need to do this in a way that rewards renewable energies, puts them on a level playing field with fossil fuels. We give permanent tax breaks to the fossil fuel industry. We should have moratoriums on drilling offshore. The environmental risks are way too high. There are things we can do and have already done, and we did under the Obama administration, now being reversed by the Trump administration, that will lead us to not being dependent on fossil fuels. America today is not dependent upon fossil fuels. So we can do much more aggressively globally, providing alternative fuels for our allies around the world so they're not as dependent upon the fossil fuels of their neighbors that are countries that disagree with our way of life. So there's a lot more we need to do.
Let's go to the phones to Andrew in Baltimore. Andrew, welcome to Midday with Senator Cardin.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Hi. I was very glad to hear the senator speak about Merrick acting against corruption. But I think we also have to worry about corruption in the United States. And it's not just the administration, but also Congress. And I was concerned by the Taxpayers First Act, where Congress is instructing the IRS not to give free services to the American people, and instead leave that to the paid industry, which has not lived up to its agreement to provide those services.
All right. Thanks for that call, Andrew. I appreciate it.
Well, first, thank you. I have legislation that passed the Senate Foreign Relations Committee last year that I hope will be enacted in this Congress that sets up international standards to judge every country in the world, including the United States, on their fight against corruption, similar to the way we've done that on fighting trafficking of humans. Because I do believe corruption is a problem in every country in the world. I do think the United States deals with corruption in the right way. We have the right laws. We have the independent judiciary. We have anti-bribery statutes. We have the framework, the right framework, to deal with corruption in America. The specific question you're asking about is the IRS free platform for taxpayers. And currently, it's being offered by private companies. The House passed a provision that would allow for this free structure to continue to be operated by the private sector rather than the IRS itself. I disagree with that, and that's the bill's being held up in the Senate.
It seemed to be succumbing to the private tax preparation industry, the H&R Block of the world.
That's correct, but in fairness to the House, they were told that it just codifies the present practice and the IRS can eliminate it upon notice. We don't know whether that's accurate or not, but that's the premise for which the House acted on the bill. We would feel much more comfortable if that provision were eliminated so the IRS is free to set up their own platform to help taxpayers and not have to rely on the private sector.
Will a version of that bill get to the Senate floor?
Yes, we will get to it. I hope that's not in it. It's an important provision that deals with tax administration issues that I have many provisions that are important to get done.
Let's go back to the phones to Richard in Lockhearn. Richard has a question about Israel. Welcome to Midday with Ben Cardin.
Good afternoon. I'm concerned about how Democrats, except for the few in the Congress that are very radical, refuse to criticize Israel for things that we would criticize any country for. I mean, we're letting the president be like a groupie for Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, first of all, I think you'll find many of us will criticize the United States, even though we love the United States. It's a strong democratic country. We love it. We think that the current leader is doing things that are against the values of America, so we criticize that. In Israel, there are many Israelis that will criticize not only Mr. Netanyahu, but just about everyone else, because it's a vibrant democracy in which there's different views. I have frequently criticized Mr. Netanyahu for his policies. When he joined a racist party during the elections for support, I spoke out very much against that. When he was here with a joint session of Congress that I thought was inappropriate, close to an election in Israel, I criticized that for being too partisan. So I do think you'll find members of both parties that will criticize the Israeli government when we think they're wrong. But the one thing I hope we could all agree is that Israel is a vibrant democracy. It is a country that shares similar values that we share. And that is a country that is a close ally and an important ally to the United States, and one in which we have a very close relationship both militarily, economically, and on values.
It is alleged that Jared Kushner has, as part of his vast portfolio, a solution to the dispute between Israelis and Palestinians. Do you have any optimism? Are you sanguine at all that the administration, in fact, is working on a proposal to solve some of the, you know, deep-seated and longstanding issues in the Middle East? And if so, what are the elements that kind of solution should contain?
You know, we've been working a long time, the United States, to try to figure out a formula that can bring the Palestinians and Israelis together in a peace process. We think it's critically important for Israel's future. We think it's very important for the Palestinians. So we believe in it. We believe in a two-state solution where you have two states living side by side, a Palestinian state and a Jewish state. We think that would not only help from a security point of view, but also from an economic point of view, all the players in the region. Plus, we do believe that it would open up tremendous economic partnerships in the region with other countries. I think the Kushner proposal, we've talked a little bit about it, will not lead towards, in the short term, a peace solution. The Israelis and the Palestinians have worked out some parts of a peace arrangement. There are certain areas, particularly in the West Bank, where you have autonomy and the Palestinians controlling most of their life today. That's a positive step forward. We still have settlement issues that are not really consistent with a viable two-state solution that have to be resolved, and they're political and difficult. That's a long answer to tell you is that I want to keep the peace process alive. I am not overly optimistic in the short term that we will see progress towards peace. It only will happen with leaders on the Palestinian and Israeli side that are willing to take courageous steps, because it will not be necessarily popular in either country to really achieve a peace process.
What are the kinds of things that the United States can do to nudge Israel along or to nudge the Palestinians along? I mean, there are folks who point to human rights violations that the Israelis are inflicting on the Palestinians. Is there a role for the United States in, you mentioned settlements, but is there, what is, at this juncture, given this president and this point in time, what is the proper, what should the proper posture of the United States be towards Israel when it comes to those kinds of concerns?
Well, if you believe in peace in the region, if you really, and the rights of all the people, to me it's clear the United States has to be unequivocal for two states living side by side in peace, a Jewish state and a Palestinian state. To me, that is the key building block for short-term, long-term peace in the region.
Let's go to Dan in Baltimore. Dan, welcome to Midday with Senator Cardin.
Yes. Since the Republicans have such a difficult time criticizing the president, and the two senators you mentioned, Flake and Corker, were retiring, so they gave them the luxury, I'm wondering if Senator Cardin would support term limits, because that maybe will be help people be more forthright instead of always worrying about reelection and putting their needs first. They put the American people's needs first. California, for example, has one of the most liberal governments in the country, if not the world, and they have term limits at every level of government, except for federal, obviously, because it will take a constitutional amendment to do so. So I'm just wondering if the senator would be in favor of term limits.
And Dan, before the senator answers that, what in your mind is the length of the limit? How long should people be serving?
I think like maybe they have in California two terms for, you know, for the senators, maybe four terms for the House. Something where that would also create vibrancy. I mean, look how vibrant the legislature is in California, how many creative ideas come about because they know that they're only going to be there for a short period of time. So it puts them, you know, a focus that they have a window of opportunity to get done things.
All right.
Get things done.
So, Senator, this comes up every election cycle.
Let me just make an observation. There are a couple Republican members of the United States Senate who have announced they're not running for reelection. Yet I've not noticed any difference in their attitude towards President Trump. These are good members. I know the members who are not running for re-election. They are honorable people, but I have not seen any change in their behavior. I think I don't think we should overreact to the person who's in the White House today in regards to the fundamental protections we have in our Constitution. I am deeply concerned about our democracies moving forward. Don't get me wrong. I think this president has done things that are extremely dangerous to the democratic institutions in America and our leadership globally in defending democratic institutions. So I don't want to minimize the risk factor. But as I said earlier, we've seen I said this president has tried to take away the power of the legislature. We've seen over a period of time presidential powers growing and legislative powers shrinking. The president's become stronger. The institution of the president's become stronger and stronger, not just in this administration, but over many administrations. By imposing term limits, you're going to take away the power of the elected members of Congress. And I think it weakens the legislative branch of government even more. I think the voters are the ultimate decision makers here. They either vote for or against the candidate who's running for office. They can, the term limit's one term. You have to win a re-election. So no, I'm not in favor of term limits.
We'll have more with Senator Ben Cardin after a quick break. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Before we go to our break, once a week here on our program, we read the names of the people who've lost their lives to violence in Baltimore during the previous week. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 118 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Police last week released the identities of three victims of homicides whose deaths were reported the week before last. They are Terrell Patterson, age 18, Dewan Conway, age 25, and Lakeisha Price. She was 42 years old. Tavon Kinchin was 15 years old when he was shot by another teenager in 1999. He died this past February as a result of complications from his injuries. Last week, city medical examiners ruled his death a homicide. Tavon Kinchin was 35 years old. Police released the names of two other homicide victims, Emmanuel Olatunji, age 24, and James Chase. He was 21. Years old. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, Maryland's senior senator Ben Cardin is my guest. Last November, he was reelected to a third term, and before being elected to the Senate, he represented Maryland's 3rd District in the House for 20 years. His more than 50 years of public service began in Annapolis, where he was a member of the House of Delegates for 2 decades, and he served as Speaker of the Maryland House for 8 years. To join our conversation, our number here at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at WIPR.org, our Twitter handle, at midday WIPR, and we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. Speaking of the Maryland House, you served as the Speaker, as I said, for 8 years. Got any advice for Adrian Jones, our new historic Speaker of the House, first Black woman elected to that position?
Adrian and I have had a chance to talk about that. Unusual circumstances. Obviously, the death of the Speaker is not something that happens very often in government. But then the way that she woke up one morning, did not expect she would be Speaker of the House, and then by the end of the day, she becomes Speaker. To me, it took a lot of courage for the manner in which she conducted herself during Mike Bush's illness, as well as stepping in now. I think, as I told her, she's got to be a healing force for the Maryland General Assembly. The key here is for the House of Delegates to exercise its collective strength. And when you have so many individuals, 141, it's not easy to speak as a united voice. And that requires the Speaker to really be able to reach out to each member of the House so they can work as a collective unit. That's particularly important today because the Senate's different. And, of course, the governor, a different party. So it's important that the House be able to act as a united group. And to me, that's the advice I gave Adrian Jones, is to reach out to recognize that she has to be that conciliatory factor.
I think there's some evidence that she's already taken you up on that advice. We have an email from Dave who says, given that a sovereign nation has the right to determine who can enter the country and who can become a citizen, please ask the senator, why has Congress surrendered our sovereignty over the past half century? And what has he done to eliminate the laws and policies that encourage illegal entrance or remainder in our country and which rewards those who do so? So, again, the issue of immigration, back to Jared Kushner, another part of his portfolio is to come up with an immigration plan, which he has briefed members of Congress about. You've been very critical mm-hmm. of that. What should immigration look like in the United right. States, and what are our chances of doing it either incrementally or in a big overhaul?
So let me agree with the question in that Congress needs to pass comprehensive immigration reform so we have an orderly way for people to come to America. They may be coming here because we need their help economically. There may be family reunifications. They may be coming here to escape persecution and the safety. There may be a lot of reasons why we should let them into the country, but we should have an orderly way to do that. And our immigration system today is broken. It's not working well. We already have in this country people who are legally here temporarily. Temporary protective status. We need to deal with that group. We have a large number of people who came here as children that are not documented. we call them the Dreamers. We got to deal with that group.
And we should say that Mr. Kushner's plan, for example, doesn't even address the Dreamers in any way.
No, it doesn't. And it doesn't really take care of the TPS status satisfactorily. So there's a so we should have comprehensive immigration reform. I'm going to, I think, differ from what that question was at least aimed at. I believe in allowing people to come here, particularly disagree with the president on vulnerable people. And today we have more displaced people in the United States, in the world, than we've had since World War II. Now in our own hemisphere, in Venezuela, millions of people have left the country because of violence, and they can't get basic services in the country. For survival, they've left. So a country like Colombia has opened up their borders, taken in a million. They're doing what is right, that is protecting human life, and the United States must do its share also to protect human life that is being persecuted around the world, and we have not done our share that we need to do under this administration.
What do you make of the president's insistence that merit, whatever that means, is the right criteria for bringing people into the country? Speaker Pelosi had some very critical things to say about this whole notion of a meritocracy somehow being the governing force behind our immigration policy.
Well, a couple points here. First, we need to have an orderly process. Therefore, there are categories. Categories, by definition, express merit or priorities, and that's fine. I'm all for that. But I want to make it clear, if you just go but with family reunification, we need to embrace diversity. America's a diverse nation. So if you're going to say we're only going to take people that come from certain backgrounds or people have certain degrees, no, I'm against that. I think that's wrong. We also see a rise globally in nationalism, which to me is extremely dangerous. We see a rise of hate around the world, a rise of anti-migrant around the world. We saw that in the elections in Europe this past week. So I just think we, America, which is, again, the leader of the free world, our values, let's make sure that our immigration policies reflect who we are as a nation, our values, and not just a very narrow function that we need more engineers or we need more agricultural workers. Let's make sure that we represent the best in the values of this country.
The European Parliament elections, as you mentioned, did have a big surge in so-called populists, right-wing politicians from many different countries: Italy, Germany, France, the party that was run by Marine Le Pen, who did very badly in the election against Emmanuel Macron, did quite well in the European Parliament elections. The Brexit Party, which didn't even exist 6 weeks ago in Great Britain, picked up a number of seats in the European Parliament, and there's great frustration among the Brexiteers about the inability for Britain to effect a leave from Europe. That, in addition to the Green parties, which also picked up an awful lot of seats, so you have these people on the left side of the environmental argument and the right side of the immigration argument, both surging in popularity in the European Parliament. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's troublesome. As this, we were talking off air, that endangered species are people that are moderate in the middle. And to me, I am very concerned about the rise of nationalism. I am the special representative of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's Parliamentary Assembly for anti-Semitism, racism, and intolerance. We've seen a rise of hate, not just in Europe, but also in the United States. We've seen people who have been marginalized, who've been living in their communities for a long period of time because they don't look the same as their neighbor, and they're being the change here is we've always had hate, but now it's finding acceptance in the social media. It's also we're finding extremists that are working themselves into governments. We see that in Poland. We see that in Hungary. We also see now extremists that are getting parliamentary seats in countries that they had none before: Germany, UK, the EU, you just mentioned. So we're finding an acceptance of hate, and that we hadn't seen until prior to World War II. So I find it very troublesome. And we have to recognize it's here. It's not something we can stop. We've seen elections. So we all have to be active to say that's not what we are as a nation, and we will not tolerate hate at all against anyone, whether it's person's religion or person's race or person's profession, such as being a journalist or a migrant. We cannot accept hate against anyone here in America. It's just wrong.
We have a ping on Facebook Live from Rob, who says, how about the NSA tools being used to destroy the IT infrastructure of Baltimore City? And this is a topic, right, by the way, that we're going to take up tomorrow. Scott Shane is a fascinating piece in the New York Times about this, that the malware was originally developed, right, by the National Security Agency and then fell into hands of bad actors. When will compensation and disaster recovery assistance be forthcoming from the feds? I mean, Brandon Scott, City Council President, has asked Governor Hogan to declare an emergency that would trigger a number of potential avenues of aid from the federal government. What are the chances of that?
Well, first, our federal delegation has asked for a briefing from the intelligence community exactly what's going on here. We have read press accounts that it is the type of hardware or software that was developed at NSA that's being used to amplify the damage being done through the cyber attacks. It may be foreign actors, other governments. It may just be bad people here in America. We want to get to the facts as to what happened, how we were so vulnerable. How can we prevent this from happening in the future? If, in fact, there was software developed by our own agency, how did that get into hands of bad people or other governments? So these are questions we want to get answered. Yes, there is a need to make sure that we do what we can to protect Baltimore City and other entities that were affected by cyber. We know that cyber attacks happen every second of the day. Some are much more serious than others. But we are all vulnerable to cyber issues, and we have to make sure that our cybersecurity is up to the challenge.
Number of states in recent weeks have passed very restrictive laws concerning the right for women to receive abortions. The putative reason for this is that they're hoping that some of these cases get to the Supreme Court and that there's a consideration about whether or not Roe v. Wade, which was passed in 1973, should be overturned. We have an email from Will who says, good afternoon, Senator. I'm a constituent and supporter. Respecting freedom of choice is it's a question of religious rights. I've never heard that argument in favor of choice. I know the Bible to be correct when it declares life begins with breath. Why can't I live in my country and practice my faith?
Well, Tom, this is the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, and we've made a lot of progress over the last 100 years on gender issues. To me, a large part of this is the respect for women to be able to make their own decisions about their health care, whether it is on contraception or whether it is on abortion. These are sensitive issues, and government should not be dictating the results. A woman's right of choice, I thought, was well settled by Roe v. Wade. It clearly is being challenged today by state legislatures and governors around the country with extremely repressive laws, criminalizing doctors' decisions that they make, trying to lock up doctors and women for decisions that they're making. It's outrageous. I thought we were well beyond this. And I can tell you, those of us in Congress, we're going to do everything we can to protect a woman's right of choice, because we think this is a fundamental freedom for women. And that government should not be interfering.
And by the way, listeners, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Lena Nguyen, who's the president of Planned Parenthood, and other scholars, legal scholars, about the abortion controversy on Friday here on Midday. Senator, we just have a few seconds left. There is a debate going on within your party about whether or not action should be taken to begin an impeachment investigation against the president. Where do you stand on that?
Of course, that'll be done in the House of Representatives. The Senate acts as a jury, so we have to be somewhat objective until the House does. I think the House has a constitutional responsibility under the Constitution to investigate the Mueller, to follow up on the Mueller report. Where it leads, I don't know, but they must exercise their oversight function and investigate this.
Senator Ben Cardin, always a pleasure, sir. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, the ransomware attack that has crippled city government in Baltimore and other places has its roots, as we mentioned, in malware developed at taxpayer expense by the National Security Agency. So we'll talk to Scott Shane of the New York Times, as well as Avi Rubin. He's a cybersecurity expert from Johns Hopkins University, about ransomware and how it affects the city and how it could affect your computer as well. That's coming up tomorrow. on Midday. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared has been recently recognized by the Daily Meal. You can find their menu and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Here and Now is up at the top of the hour after news from NPR, so stick around. Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing to our podcast. Thanks for your tweets, your emails, and your calls. And thanks for listening. Have a great day.